I want to welcome you to the afternoon sessions on our conference on the Rambam. It's really my pleasure to introduce my good friend Ken Green. Dr. Green and I both had the privilege of being taught by Alan Bloom, the late Alan Bloom, political theorist from the University of Chicago. Dr. Green received his BA from the University of Toronto in 1977, his PhD in Near Eastern and Judaic Studies from Brandeis in 1989. He's taught in the Department for the Study of Religion at the University of Toronto since 1987. His publications include Jew and Philosopher, The Return to Maimonides in the Jewish Thought of Leo Strauss, and Jewish Philosophy and the Crisis of Modernity, Essays and Lectures in Modern Jewish Thought by Leo Strauss. And he is currently editing Leo Strauss's Essays on Maimonides as part of the SUNY Press series, The Jewish Writings of Leo Strauss, for which he is the series editor. He's been invited to lecture on Jewish philosophy at Boston University, Tufts, Boston College, University of Chicago, Middlebury College, and the Shalem Center in Jerusalem. And obviously there is a certain theme to Professor Green's writings, which is the Straussian outlook on Maimonidean thought. Obviously an outlook which has engendered not a little controversy, both in the academic and the non-academic worlds in the 20th century. So it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Ken Green.
Thank you, Elliot, for that very kind and generous introduction. It's a pleasure to speak to you as part of the conference on Maimonides and the transformation of Judaism, and I have to follow three such superb speakers. They're all hard acts to follow, but since am I not using it? I think I'm using it. Maybe there's two microphones working there. Since Professor Diamond called himself the warm-up act, I'll call myself the wind-up act, so I'll try to bring things to a smooth conclusion, if that's possible, when talking about Leo Strauss. In honor of the 800th Yahrzeit of the Rambam, we gather together to study and debate the meaning of his thought and his historical impact on Judaism, which is entirely appropriate because the right way to honor him, because one of the primary values of him and his books is the advancement of the intellectual excellence of the Jews. And it's a pleasure to join with three like-minded scholars who have been dedicated to bringing that mission of Maimonides to all of you here today and out into the wider world as well. Maimonides was undoubtedly a genius. I think that that word, however misused, really applies to him as it does to few others in history. And one of the things that he did as a genius was to redirect and refocus the spiritual energy of Jews and Judaism, and such that we have never been the same since. I was going to just quote it, but I should remind you where it comes from. As Isidore Twersky put it, at one time the dean of Mishneh Torah scholars, all of subsequent Jewish intellectual history has been an argument for and against Maimonides, and our era is no exception. I don't think that's an exaggeration on Twersky's part. However much he may seem to have been accepted in the last 800 years as a pillar of orthodoxy, he remains a controversial and even revolutionary thinker. And Professor Lasker mentioned the Maimonidean controversy. That's only the least of the things which we can credit him with. I see that not as so much as an accidental effect of his revolution, but rather as a kind of quasi-intentional effect of his revolution. Look at how the Jewish mystics used, or if you prefer, abused Maimonides and remade him in their own image. Consider, if you will, Jacob Emden in the 18th century, who styled himself Yavetz and who wondered if the guide was not a forgery, a book falsely attributed to Maimonides. since the true Rambam, at least in his mind, was obviously the Rambam of the Mishneh Torah, and the two didn't fit together, therefore couldn't be his. Or in recent memory, I can recall Professor Chaim Soloveitchik speaking at the U of T and asking in all seriousness whether the Rambam might not have been a schizophrenic, since it was the honest conclusion to reach that the two sides of Maimonides just don't fit together in one mind. Now, I don't think we can chop the Rambam in half and abandon one half, whichever half you may happen to prefer, as superfluous, while retaining only the other half as authentic. A Judaism from which the Rambam has been banished, even only a part of the Rambam has been banished, is almost unimaginable. So significant has been the force of his thought in the development of contemporary Judaism, and contemporary, I mean, of the last few centuries. But this does give you an inkling of the difficulty of taking the full and proper measure of Maimonides. And I think that one of the keys to understanding that is that Maimonides conceals hidden depths. Out of those hidden depths keep coming, what shall we call them, revolutionary impulses. And it challenges the consensus of every settlement that Judaism reaches with itself over the centuries, because ultimately each of those settlements have been too one-dimensional for the Rambam himself. And therefore, I would have to say that it's by no means an undeserved flattery when we say about him, from Moses to Moses, there's none like Moses, because there really are one or two great souled figures in the history of Judaism who seem to embrace everything that it stands for, and at the same time to have the power to, shall we say, bring it back from the dead when it often seems to be in one of those lower troughs that Professor Seiskin talked about. It's also a challenge for me to speak to you today because I've been asked to, I haven't been asked explicitly, the title contains it in a hidden way, I've been asked to speak to you about the insights of Leo Strauss on Maimonides, and that's by no means a simple task. I happen to think that he was perhaps the most important and powerful interpreter of Maimonides in the 20th century, but he was certainly the first one in recent times that claimed that that Maimonides had deeper thoughts than those which appear on the surface. Now, I didn't choose the title of this talk exactly in the way that it came out. My good friend Elliot Malamud did, and I think he did it as an eminent teacher because he realized it has a much more challenging and provocative quality than the rather dull title which I had originally given to my talk, so as perhaps to hide something. But, he's making me not letting me get away with that and forcing me to deal with this thing on the surface. Certainly the topic Strauss and Maimonides is of exceptional scholarly interest because the whole field of Maimonidean studies, the whole field of study of medieval Jewish thought, has been revolutionized by Strauss, maybe not quite in as powerful a way as the Rambam himself, but certainly there is no aspect of the study of the Rambam that can escape dealing with what Strauss said. The arguments are on one side or for or against and very vehement, but they're everywhere in this field. Now, therefore, since I think take it for granted that most people have either never heard of Leo Strauss, or if they have heard of him, don't know much about him, let me say a little bit about Strauss himself. As a modern Jewish thinker, as a political philosopher. Certainly, some people may have heard of Strauss because he's gotten a wee bit of attention in the U.S., maybe in the world media, even though in his own life he did everything he could to avoid the spotlight or the limelight, if you prefer. I'm referring to the use of Strauss's name in recent American politics, usually associated with the neoconservative side of the political debate, and curiously something that most Jews, certainly in the United States, don't seem to identify themselves with, although it's also a fact that the neoconservative movement is mostly made up of Jews, so there's a kind of interesting paradox there. Strauss is often praised or blamed for as the kind of the leading intellectual light of neoconservative thought, and he's been praised or blamed at various points in the last 20 years, I guess we could say. First of all, it happened during the Reagan presidency, it reappeared during the Newt Gingrich ascendancy in Congress, and it has reached a kind of crescendo, and by no means a friendly one, during the George W. Bush presidency. What's it all about? Well, this isn't a talk on Leo Strauss per se, so I won't handle this hot potato for very long. I don't want my fingers to get burned, and I don't want this to turn into a political discussion. In fact, I was tempted to avoid it completely. But on the other hand, I realized that it wouldn't do Strauss wouldn't do justice to the talk if this didn't become part of our discussion. And I'll bring out in a moment why I think that's the case. But let me add one other little piece of throw something else into the stew here, and this has to do with something that Elliot mentioned, wherever Elliot is, about both of us studying with Alan Bloom. Strauss has recently been immortalized in literature in the novel by Saul Bellow called Ravelstein, which is about his friend Alan Bloom. But more importantly for our purposes today is that Bloom's philosophic mentor is a character that Bellow calls Felix Davar. Now, if we translate this Hebrew-Latin name with its seemingly allegorical thrust, we see that he has given Strauss the name Happy Word. Davar is the man who, according to Bellow, is in some ways the prototypical Jew, the teacher and writer. And in, at least in that novel, in Bellow's presentation, Jews are the quintessential teachers almost by nature. Now, you could say by nature, that doesn't seem to quite fit and certainly goes against the Rambam, but I think, in fact, the Rambam comes in here because it was Maimonides, certainly in Strauss's presentation, who made the Jews into the quintessential teachers, into the followers of and the advocates of the word, of Devar. On the other hand, you could ask me whether it's about politics or whether it's about literature, why I'm telling you all of these interesting stories, however exciting they may be, do they pertain to our main topic? But I think, in fact, they do, and it may have passed by you rather quickly in what I was saying, but let me try to clarify for a moment. It's certainly curious, and I would say maybe even remarkable and noteworthy, that a Jewish thinker who spent a significant portion of his life, scholarly life, studying Maimonides, the Rambam, and especially his guide, and who changed the way that we read that book and maybe changed the way that we read the Rambam, has been at the center of American political debate, the most important country in the world at this point, and somehow or other, whether it's good or bad for the Jews, which of course is a legitimate question for Strauss himself, as he would have recognized, not necessarily one that other Jews would like to ask. It is important somehow or other that this has something to do with Maimonides, and Strauss himself was the last one to deny that connection to Maimonides. So it's crucial to note that connected to this, that Strauss was the man who contributed to putting Maimonides on the map again as a philosopher and, I would say, as a Jewish thinker. Not as an antiquarian thing, not as something we study because it was in the past and he was very interesting and he made an impact and, you know, we'd like to know where we came from, but rather as a vital current in both Jewish thought and in contemporary philosophy. Now, of course, all of us here today, I think, are clear about the fact that the Rambam has always been a vital source insofar as halakha is concerned. We don't have any doubt about that, and we don't need Leo Strauss to remind us of that. But the fact is that in the area of thought, in the area of theology, and not just in the matter of the 13 principles, he has been relegated, I think, by most people, at least until Strauss came along, to an obsolete medieval thinker. Useful to study, important in some respects for a contribution that he made, but really fairly irrelevant in terms of what for contemporary Judaism. Strauss single-handedly reversed this state of affairs. He contended that the presumption should be, as he said at one point in one of his books about creating a contrary prejudice, the presumption should be in favor of Maimonides as a deeper thinker than every other modern Jewish thinker, and that other modern Jewish thinkers need to prove that they are, let's say, superior to him, because the study of him shows, at least according to Strauss's contention, that he is still greater than any of his modern competitors. Now, this would get us, if I were to really try to clarify what Strauss had in mind here, we would, of course, have to, all kinds of questions come to mind about, people have already talked about somebody, I forget who, in one of the previous talks, mentioned that Maimonides was by no means, a kind of pluralist, and he wasn't probably a liberal democrat, and other things that most modern Jews would want to identify with. To make the effort to show that he was a modern thinker, we'd have to go into it more. But ultimately, I'm bringing you all of this news about Leo Strauss, if it is news to you, because of what I hope to clarify about how he contributed to the discussion of Maimonides. And that leads us to perhaps the most important topic, the topic that's raised in the question of my talk today. That is, did Strauss discover how to read Maimonides properly? Is his reading more or less an accurate reading? And thirdly, can we move, even if that both those previous questions are answered in the affirmative, can we move from that to say that Strauss correctly, based on the method of reading that he discovered, came up with, let's say, the content of Maimonidean teaching? In other words, to put it into how Strauss, Maimonides are wedded here in this presentation, did Strauss legitimately draw ideas from Maimonides, which he employed for his own modern thought? Well, let me fill you in on at least a few details about Strauss himself, because I've given you a lot of generalities, but you don't perhaps know who he was. He was born in Germany in 1899. He was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home. He tells us that he received a basic but not deep instruction in Jewish sources, that he was impressed with the piety of his parents because of the strictness of their adherence to halacha, but that his parents were not very knowledgeable, and that he had to acquire all of his Jewish, well, or most of his Jewish knowledge by himself, which he did do after he left home. The other thing about his parents' home that he tells us is that their attitude of Jewish solidarity deeply impressed him in the care that they showed, this was in 1905, for Jews wandering through his town as refugees, fleeing to Germany, which of course is something we don't think of. Well, I guess we do again now in the era of Russian Jews going there. Fleeing to Germany after the pogroms in Tsarist Russia. But the thing that changed Strauss's life was his conversion, as he calls it, to Zionism, political Zionism in 1916. When he was 17, he became a follower of Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky. And he went on to write a doctoral dissertation under Ernst Cassirer, who was a great disciple of one of the greatest modern Jewish philosophers, Hermann Cohen. Hermann Cohen you may have heard of if you've followed the study of Jewish philosophy at all, because of his connection to Joseph Soloveitchik, for whom he was his philosophic mentor. Strauss taught in Franz Rosenzweig's Lehrhaus in Frankfurt. He was a scholar at the Academy for the Study of Judaism in Berlin, but then in 1932 he left Germany. Luckily for him, he got a Rockefeller grant right before Hitler came to power, and he escaped first to France, then to England, and finally to the United States, where he became a citizen and spent the rest of his life. He taught at two universities where he made his major impact, first the New School for Social Research in New York, and finally, more importantly perhaps, at the University of Chicago. During that period, he became the Strauss who is famous today, the one who is renowned as a teacher, and had a great influence as a thinker. Now, Strauss spent about 50 of his 73 years, as he tells us, studying intensively the works of Maimonides, and in particular, the Mor Nebuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed. The English translation that we have today, the excellent English translation by Shlomo Pinas, is really a product of Strauss's school, and as has been pointed out, most of the study of the Rambam that goes on in Israel today is because of Pinas, is influenced by Strauss's method, which focuses both on the importance of politics in the Rambam and on careful reading of his text. Strauss also wrote on parts of the Mishneh Torah, Sefer HaMadah in particular, but there's no doubt that he wasn't primarily interested in Maimonides as a halachic thinker so much as a philosophic thinker. Strauss's search for wisdom in Maimonides as a living thinker, as I've been trying to present him so far, culminated in his rediscovery or his discovery or rediscovery of what's been called Maimonidean esotericism. That's where the question in the title of my talk comes in. Did Maimonides hide what he really thought about Judaism? This has been a controversial discovery among students of Maimonides ever since Strauss first wrote about it in the 1930s and 40s. He recovered the fact that, first of all, in his book Persecution and the Art of Writing, which is essays on the Rambam, on Yehuda Levi, and on Baruch Spinoza, he recovered the fact that Maimonides himself had announced at the beginning of the guide that he was going to write this book, as we call it, esoterically. Namely, he tells us that there are seven rules for reading all books. Every book contains contradictions, any book that's worth reading. And there are some books which are written with unwitting contradiction, where the author really doesn't know what he's talking about, so he'll say one thing in one part and another thing in another part. And then there are books which are written in which the author knows what he's doing and intentionally contradicts himself. The implication being, really, that there is no book written without contradictions. The only question is, what kind of intentionality is in this? Maimonides tells us there, as Strauss was wont to emphasize, that there are two of the strongest reasons, I won't go into all the details of what they are, that for writing esoterically or secretly or between the lines, Maimonides himself will employ. He tells us that he will employ them, and therefore gives us a clue about proper reading of his book. Now, of course, the interesting thing about all of this is that until Strauss came along in the middle of the 20th century, and let's say that modern study of Maimonides had probably begun a couple of centuries before, maybe in fact with Yaakov Emden, nobody had really paid much attention to this fact, even though the Rambam is extremely explicit. And by the way, he's not just explicit about this in the Mor Nebuchim. He also talks about it in the introduction to his Perush on the Mishnah, his commentary on the Mishnah, and he there talks, I guess, really about partly the theme that I'm going to focus on, which is not so much exactly what did he hide, and of course, you know, like somebody asked me in Shul on Shabbat when they saw that I was giving this talk, you know, so new, you know, did he or didn't he, yes or no, and I said, I can't tell you, it's a secret. So, I mean, I can't, if there are secrets, I can't give them away. I wouldn't be doing, wouldn't be respectful to the Rambam. But there is, at least we can explore here, let's say, why somebody does this kind of thing. And as I said in the introduction to the commentary on the Mishnah, he makes clear there that any writer, thinker worth his salt will have to hide his views to some extent or another. Nobody says everything that they think. I mean, you could also apply it to common sense and ordinary life. We all know, to some extent, that we say one thing sometimes and do another. It's not out of malicious intent. It's just partly out of the, I mean, you can begin with this common sense level with the needs of living among other human beings, but it grows into something larger, which I hope I'll be able to bring out. So what is this esotericism, this strange thing that Strauss seems to have rediscovered? Well, first of all, let me mention another kind of preliminary to this. I mean, I hope by the time I build up all the preliminaries, you won't have lost sight of where we're going. But I said that they had forgotten about this fact of the Rambam for at least two centuries. But it should also be noted that almost all, no, maybe all of the medieval Mefarshim, the medieval commentators on the guide, were clear that Maimonides wrote esoteric, that he hid things, that he didn't say everything that he thought, and that you have to learn to read him properly if you're going to understand it. So in that way, Strauss wasn't being original at all. He was just bringing back to light something that was known for, well, let's say 600 years by a rich tradition of commentaries on the Morach Nevuchim. On the other hand, he did have, an agenda in bringing this to light, because he thought that it had implications for modern Judaism as well. He taught, those who were going to read him properly, that you have to dig for the truth. The truth is a kind of buried treasure. Its value would be lost if it was just on the surface. If it was left there for everybody to take it and mishandle it, it would inevitably abuse. Therefore, it must be protected. I guess maybe the best modern statement of this was given by Winston Churchill during the middle of the Second World War, in order to justify propaganda, which was engaged in by the West in order to justify its war against Nazi Germany. And his way of putting it was, in wartime, truth is so precious that it must be protected by a bodyguard of lies. So, if we take that general statement of Churchill's and apply it to the Rambam, we see that that is, in a sense, the condition in which the serious thinker exists in, I would say, in Judaism, but perhaps in every religious tradition. Now, this has something to do with themes that my colleagues have already talked about, namely the proneness of religion, perhaps, to that thing that we sometimes call superstition or idolatry or other things, but that natural tendency of most human beings cannot be resisted directly, but sometimes has to be fought by underground measures, which is what this is. Now, by the way, it's also true, and the Rambam built on this fact, that this was not new even in the Middle Ages. The Rambam could claim to have drawn this out of the most ancient Jewish sources. We know from rabbinic tradition that there are two themes that the rabbis tell us should not be discussed in public with everyone. Masa Bereshit and Masa Merkava, or the account of the creation and the account of the chariot, Genesis 1 and Ezekiel 1, right? These two chapters that have about them very profound mysteries, and which in one way or another are not meant to be understood by everybody easily. These are the secrets of the Torah. And by the way, for the Rambam, and in his understanding, in the Rambam's understanding for the ancient rabbis, this has nothing to do with mysticism. This has been taken over by the Kabbalah in the era after the Rambam. But he was absolutely clear that this is not necessarily, this was absolutely not connected to a mystical teaching. You can be a strict rationalist and still believe in secret teachings which have to be kept secret. I can use a term that's popular today, but it inevitably leads to misunderstandings, but in some ways it does convey a little bit of the truth. That is to say that the Torah contains a code. Okay, now immediately everybody thinks of the Torah codes that Eishet Torah was kind of spreading abroad at one point. I don't know if it's quite so popular anymore, but it seems to me at least it was. There's a code, but it's not that kind of code for the Rambam. And in particular, of course, it's not the code that supposedly finds in the Torah predictions for present or future events. You know, it's not a kind of time machine or futurology device or any of that kind of stuff. It's not about future events. Rather, it's about truths, moral, speculative, scientific, which sometimes are best not known by everybody. Now, this goes against our sort of most deeply held modern liberal democratic principles, which is, of course, transparency. I mean, in politics, it makes a lot of sense that, you know, we shouldn't have secrets, and our governments shouldn't have secrets from us, at least insofar as it's necessary. I mean, as far as we can avoid that to deal with enemies and such. But that's really not the answer that the Rambam would give. He saw truth, which the Torah contains, as itself a kind of labyrinth, which requires a certain, or if you prefer the mountain analogy of Moshe, but let's stick with the labyrinth for a moment, or a maze, which requires a certain kind of spiritual traveler to get to the center of things. That person must be agile of mind, must be resolute of soul, and must have certain moral character traits. If that person has those things, then they will be able to, first of all, dig up the secret map of hidden treasure, and secondly, find themselves. I mean, this kind of reminds me of some of these science fiction or, I don't know, computer-type games that the kids play where you have to know a certain password to get onto the next level or whatever, except the password, again, as with the codes, is not some kind of arbitrary made-up thing, but it's a kind of inner quality of the searcher, a kind of level of soul and mind which is presupposed for one who can go to the center. So, Maimonides, let's say, is asserting that the Torah contains this buried treasure which is concealed deliberately. So what is it? I mean, is it then, this leads us to the next stage of the discussion, is it then just a kind of set of fixed teachings, a kind of, you know, list of propositions or doctrines, you know, Masim Breshit, Masim Merkava, as, you know, kind of encyclopedia articles that we can eventually find the right page of and read them and go home and feel like we know the truth, or the answers to the math problems in the back of the book. That's not quite what he means. Ultimately, and this is where I think it gets very subtle and tricky, in the last analysis, the truth, which is in the center of things, is not a set of dogmas. It's not even a set of abstruse, sophisticated, philosophical dogmas, as might seem to be the case when we use this language, but rather it's something to do with, what shall we say, a kind of way of life, a kind of attitude toward the teachings of the Torah. That ultimately, therefore, I mean, maybe I'm ignoring the obvious, and for a moment I should go back a few steps. On the surface, it looks like it is a set of fixed dogmas. The 13 principles, which is not, of course, in the Guide of the Perplexed, but in the commentary in the Mishnah, is kind of an obvious example of that. I mean, in fact, any of you know or have ever looked at or opened up the Guide of the Perplexed will know that it's anything but, you know, an easy or even a clear set of statements of what's true and what's false. But there is, at various points, whether in the Mishnah Torah, whether in the commentary on the Mishnah, whether in the guide itself, various points at which it seems as if he is giving us, you know, the truth, so to speak, with a capital T. But my argument is that that is just a stage in the process, according to the Rambam. And I know that when people hear this, because whenever I've tried to explain it to students before, it always sounds like something mystical. It sounds like mysticism, and it's often, you know, kind of gets confused with it, but it really is not about that. I kind of keep repeating that. I hope by the end it will be a little bit clear to you why I'm saying that. Maimonides is therefore saying that there isn't a kind of vision of absolute perfection, of fixed teachings which has been revealed in the Torah or by means of prophecy, which we just have to make, you know, a difficult ascent to, like the Ten Commandments, and come back with them, and then we've got it all. I mean, it's by no means, I don't want to be misunderstood here, as with Ken Siskin, when somebody misheard him and to say that, you know, the Rambam doesn't believe in prayer. That's not what he was trying to say. I'm not trying to say, therefore, there aren't any fixed teachings. There are fixed teachings. But the ultimate truth is not something that's easily grasped in that fashion. It is buried treasure, but it's not like a chest that we open up and take out the gold pieces. In other words, what I'm really getting at here is that the Rambam did not remain satisfied with a notion of religion Judaism or any other religion, as kind of a complete system unto itself, a comprehensive mode of thought that just comes out ready-made like a printout from a computer. And that leads us to one of the points that's very easy to miss in the Rambam, and I think Strauss here brings it out very nicely. The Rambam leaves room for doubt in the very heart of his theology, something which it would seem is antithetical to faith, to religion, but in fact, the Rambam thinks it's absolutely essential for faith. There has got to be this realm of doubt in the midst of the search for truth in religion, or religion will become stultified. It'll become that thing I talked about earlier when I said we get to a kind of, you know, easy consensus or a one-dimensional Judaism where, so even though he himself did in some ways set up such a system, he wanted us, he expected us to go beyond that. He was aware, as every philosopher is, that there's a problematic character, a questionable quality to every final resolution on the matter of the truth, the perfect final conclusion about everything that the Torah is supposed to offer us is not really such a good thing. The Torah is perfect precisely because it doesn't give us those easy answers. Now, this is not something that most people are going to be happy with. This making into doubt a crucial element, a fundamental element, certainly fundamental to the philosophic experience, as making this a part of religion seems to be contradictory to what we think of, both as the Rambam's purpose and what we think of as religion in general. And that's because for the Rambam, and here we kind of have to add another piece into the puzzle, the defense of Judaism requires that we see it as possessing, as every worthwhile human spiritual enterprise, an elite which is more engaged with the process of searching for the truth than other people are. A spiritual elite. So this is not an elitism which says that, you know, these guys get more privileges and those guys don't. It's not something which issues in any kind of material consequences. It doesn't. It's a quality that one observes about the facts of life, that there are always only very few people in this room, in the large body of Toronto Jewry, we get out, you know, 60 or 70 people or whatever numbers there are here who will come and study the Rambam on a Sunday. These are serious people. But the fact is, there are lots of other people who would be shopping at Vaughan Mills or wherever else because that seems like a more worthwhile enterprise. Now, I'm not saying that I don't go shopping, whatever, too. But the fact is that there is a kind of seriousness that characterizes perhaps only some people. Now, the other element of this that's important for Maimonides is that this elite, this spiritual elite, and again, it's not a fixed entity, and it's not something that you can, produce in some ways at will, although the Rambam did try to do so. I mean, even Thomas Jefferson talked about the virtue of democracy is that it allows the natural aristocracy, the natural elite, to come to the surface. The free society is better in that regard. That was, in a way, what the Rambam was saying in advance. So, his purpose then became, if we look at what the transformation of Judaism that we're talking about, is to consciously, and in his mind, this went on through the whole history of Judaism. This goes back to Moses. This goes on through the prophets and later rabbinic tradition. I mean, this is not something he's inventing. That the challenge of leadership at any time in the history of Judaism is to cultivate, select, and train a spiritual elite who will lead the people. Now, this elite has to be properly trained, you know, can't be just sort of designated at will and say, okay, you're part of the elite, now you go off and do whatever you want to do, because, of course, they won't do it right. They have to be given the proper training. That training will come through studying the Rambam's works, whether it's the Mishnah Torah or whether it's the Guide or the Perplexed. These type of people, by the way, will also be the type of people who can handle that thing I talked about before, philosophic doubt. And in fact, not only can they handle it, they will need it. They need this thing in their lives, whereas most people don't need it. In fact, it wouldn't do them any good to have it. So these people will, I mean, this is the perplexed Rabbi Joseph at the beginning of the guide, to whom, as Professor Diamond said, the book is written. It's written a series of letters. The format of the book is as letters to an individual student who is suffering from this state of doubt in which he exists. The particulars of his case are, you know, relevant to that time, but I think ultimately goes beyond it. I mean, in his time, it was a conflict between Aristotelian philosophy and science and the traditions of the Torah. But I would say that what he's talking about could be, and in Rambam's mind, would be applied as much to the relevant, you know, differences of how that occurs today as it did then. These type of people are bothered by questions of theology that don't work, don't fit, don't make any sense. These type of people are bothered by the fact that sometimes the halakha, the law, doesn't quite conform to the principles that it's supposed to conform to. And they're being sensitive souls, they are suffering from that conflict. The Rambam is showing them the way out. And at the same time, trying to grab these people, because they are the most important people to keep the whole society in motion. To keep the Torah in motion, we need these kinds of people, and to keep it in the proper direction of its motion. So, how does this work in terms of the theological logic that the Rambam applies to the Torah? He maintains that this goes back to the original prophet, to Moshe himself. And every prophet worth his salt will repeat this. The true prophet, according to the Rambam, possesses the ability, which is a kind of superhuman, but not supernatural, it's just kind of like a Superman-like quality, to communicate on various levels to various people. And in particular, I would say on two levels to the two basic types of people. Or, well, actually, I'm going to make it into three in a moment, so don't take me too literally there. The two basic levels are the imaginative level and the intellectual level. The level of pictures and metaphors and analogies, or the level of abstract conceptual thought. Those are two different levels. But, he's saying, the two can be, and indeed in the best type of system, have to be woven together. Now, in fact, I said I'm going to come back because there are three levels. There are three types of people, according to the Rambam, to whom the Torah is directed. And in the teachings of the Torah, this threefold message of the true prophet is dialectically or pedagogically intertwined. The Torah becomes a kind of ladder of ascent by means of numerous rungs. But it is ultimately a three-tiered system, the three types of people. What are those three types? First of all, it trains all people to religious piety and to moral goodness. That's the simple folk. Secondly, it prepares the life of the higher moral and religious type, the more decent person, the person who is attracted to noble spiritual thoughts and who wants to fulfill God's law, but also concerned about having the correct and the most intelligent beliefs about him. And thirdly, it guides the person who's already on that level, the philosopher, or if you prefer, perhaps Rambam's language, the prophet, the prophetic type, or the potential prophet. And the Torah, therefore, allows, or makes allowance for, the search for wisdom of those two higher types within the way of life that it leads. This is within the law. I mean, don't forget that the guide is itself described as the true science of the law. This is not a contradiction in the sense that it's about law, but ultimately, so it's a political thing, but it's about producing this higher type. So the real challenge really exists at the level of the middle and the high type. The high type, in a way, can sort of, the exceptions, as somebody once said, can fend for themselves. They'll find their own way, but they're very few and far between. The multitude, as Maimonides calls them, the masses, will, if given proper guidance, lead a good and decent life. It's those people in the middle that present the real problem, because they have to decide which way they will go. Will they go toward search for knowledge of the truth, which requires a difficult life, not an easy life? I mean, in the way that Professor Siskin described Judaism as a hard religion, I would say that it's particularly hard for the people who take this element seriously. I'm not sure it's hard for other people so much, except insofar as it's hard to be a Jew, but that's not the same as Judaism per se. So it's out of that conflict or reality of those two human types, the higher type, who Maimonides ultimately aims for, and the middle type, who's deciding whether to go up or go down, that esotericism, secret messages, if you will, secret meanings within his teachings have to be imprinted to keep the two basic classes of human beings, really, in Maimonides' understanding, the few, the spiritual few or the philosophic few, and the non-philosophic many, that keep them together in one common life, the life of Judaism. So how does he do that? He does it by means of one important strategy: study of the religious texts of the Torah and the whole literature coming out of Torah. That is the common ground on which these opposed types can encounter one another, can see what their common grounds are, and at the same time that the elite can learn vital truths about the many. So it's in textual encounter that the clash occurs, but it's also in textual encounter that the Jewish philosophic student is prevented from going astray. The Jewish philosophic student may be brought by his enlightenment to unthinkingly reject the whole religion, or at least important parts of it, as primitive, as superstitious, as not sources of knowledge. The Rambam teaches that student why those things are there, and why they must be there, and why there can be a harmony in fitting those things into a religion which embraces these two human types, the type who searches for wisdom and those who are simply living a decent or good life. I mean, in some ways, this goes back to the points, just to tie together. I said I'm doing the wind-up act, so I'm tying up something that Professor Diamond said when he talked about the stages in history, in the development of human history. You know, the most infamous or infamous case of this for the Rambam is in part 3, I think it's chapter 32, where he talks about the sacrifices. And there, of course, he gives it a historical explanation. Now, without getting into the details of that, you know, the main point of it is that people do not change suddenly from one thing to another. The whole process of history, in a way, is the education of the human race, partly and maybe largely helped by Judaism. There we go to Professor Lasker's talk with the relationship of Judaism to Christianity and Islam. The Jewish philosophic student who comes to learn from Maimonides learns a prudent and wise respect for religion, for revealed texts, which up to then had been perplexing to him, which didn't seem to make any sense, which seemed to contain a content that he thought of as irrational and maybe even foolish. But, of course, saying this is always a problematic pursuit. There are lots of people out there who are not going to be happy. And we know from the instance of the Maimonidean controversy that there were lots of people over several centuries who didn't like what he said. So you have to sometimes conceal it and make it hard for even that spiritual elite to come to understand. And those are why the Rambam employs artful literary devices to sometimes conceal radical arguments, because from the obvious level they're a threat to the piety of the simple faithful, but also on a higher level they're a threat to the moral and cognitive development even of the Jewish philosophic student, who he hopes will become part of that elite that will lead Judaism, and perhaps through Judaism the whole of humanity, forward in the march of history. So there's a concern in this thing called esotericism, in hiding what he thought, for the proper order in uncovering the truth. You don't just get it all spilled out there and then you just sort of sweep it up into a bag and go home and you got the truth. It doesn't work like that. You have to struggle for it, and in struggling for it, you have to form your soul so that you understand why some things are necessary in religion which don't look to be contributory to the higher purposes. So, The message of all of this is that what Rambam was engaged in doing this thing called esotericism, and I said to you, I'm not going to give away the secrets, I'm just going to try to show you why somebody might employ them. The purpose of the Rambam in doing what he was doing is to produce an elite of Jewish philosophic students who would educate the Jews and create a future which would move in the right direction. And therefore, I was respectfully disagree with him when he said that in some ways he thinks that. I mean, like he also said he succeeded, but in the ways that he failed, I'm not sure even the things that looked like failures were failures. I'm not sure that they weren't things he expected would probably happen because the struggle is long and hard. The struggle is, again, as I began my talk, for intellectual excellence among the Jews, which he thought was, in a way, the mark of revelation. That is a curious definition. But it is, in a way, the thing on which he sees the teaching of Judaism to be founded. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily go down well for lots of people, and therefore maybe you do have to keep it somewhat under the surface. Strauss, coming back to him for a moment, made his name in Jewish scholarly circles by reiterating this subtle method of Maimonides, by bringing it to light again, and ultimately, I would say, by suggesting that this has relevance for us in the here and now. Never mind, let's forget the political side of it, but let's just look at Judaism. What he found in Maimonides' thought, concealed beneath the wonderful literary surface of the text, was a passion, a Maimonidean passion, for the life of the mind in any adequate approach to Judaism. And therefore, in producing the highest intellectual excellence or virtue in an elite class of Jewish students, one has the most difficult, but also the most important task in the life of Judaism. It's one that's fraught with risks, of course. The production of this kind of human individual is always somewhat dangerous because this type of person, this extremely sensitive mind, has an easy tendency to fall off into one or extreme or another. So one must be extremely artful in educating them, which is, of course, what the Rambam was doing in writing the way he did. But, on the other hand, you could say, therefore, in response to that, well, why bother if it's dangerous, if you can, you know, if you're fraught with producing people who will end up, you know, questioning Judaism and leaving it or whatever, maybe we should, you know, leave it alone and just present it as simple, you know, as is on the surface stuff. Maimonides felt, this is, I think, one of the things that Strauss brings out, that it's imperative, the task in which he was engaged, is imperative for the well-being and future survival of the Jewish people. Maimonides saw, from the days of the patriarchs and the prophets, in other words, in the very earliest times, that the distinguishing mark of the Jews, and this perhaps, again, is echoed by what Professor Siskin and Professor Diamond said about Abraham, the distinguishing mark of the Jews from the very beginning is their ability to discern and receive the highest truths, their devotion to the life of the mind, their pursuit of knowledge in the philosophic and scientific sense, which culminates ultimately in the comprehensive wisdom about God. So it's this notion of the history of Judaism that was guiding Maimonides himself in his efforts as a great teacher, and I would suggest to you that Strauss found appealing. And he stressed in his philosophic argument, both in bringing out the esotericism of the Rambam and perhaps in developing his own thought, which again I'm not going to go more than I have to into because that's a whole other topic. But this elite then of Jewish philosophical students, which is difficult to produce, will receive the same moral education as everyone else. They will be held to the same or maybe even higher moral standards than everyone else, but their intellectual excellence will be the guarantee for the health of the people, the soul of the people, and will enable Judaism to survive and to meet the challenges that it will face. He also happens to think, this is more in the Rambam than I would say than so much what Strauss presents, that such intellectual perfection, when it is produced, and he uses his example here as mostly as prophets, it overflows to a higher moral excellence as well. That there are, in a sense, higher human types who come out of of this process, and therefore it has a political purpose of the most important sort that really could be connected with the tradition of philosophy. I mean, in this sense, he is really agreeing with Socrates in saying that proper knowledge is true virtue. So, Strauss learned from Maimonides and taught about Maimonides that he thought that religion is essential to any healthy political society. He thought that the Jewish religion in particular is essential for the grounding of any genuine morality. And he also thought that while the truths of morality may be accessible to some few philosophers, it's essential for the well-being of the world that Judaism teach the truths that it teaches, even though he could imagine philosophers who weren't in need of it. They were, again, those exceptions who can fend for themselves. Strauss learned from Maimonides that biblical religion plays a key role in the ennoblement of human beings, which, of course, he saw in these other religions, at least in potentia, and that ultimately Judaism can resist any attempts, and this is where the danger is held off, to refute it by means of reason. So, let me come back and finish on one last note. I know I don't want to go over time, but I just want to reemphasize one last point, the one that I talked about a little while ago, and that is the notion that Judaism, like philosophy, must leave room for doubt. Doubt is not the antithesis of faith in the Rambam's view. The Jew, like the philosopher, must be able to search for knowledge by means of questioning whatever dearly held beliefs the tradition espouses. Now, that truth that is doubted, on the other hand, does not have to be flaunted in public. Most people can't live with those excruciating doubts. And yet they're absolutely necessary for that spiritual elite. So there you see the impulse behind esotericism, to leave freedom for doubt, freedom for thought in the heart of Judaism, but not disturb the peace of ordinary people. You must, in other words, according to the Rambam, communicate whatever doubts you have esoterically. You must write them between the lines, as Strauss puts it, and maybe even mask doubts about some of the most revered traditional truths. But, and here's my last point, however much the philosopher like the Rambam may wish to change some of those revered beliefs that he doesn't think are beneficial or are not true, he must do so, he must achieve that end by being guided by the means of law. You must be, in other words, guided by higher authority. And in the case of Judaism, that is the law brought by Moses, who has left the freedom in his law to harmonize the conflict of human types in society. To Strauss, Maimonidean wisdom permits philosophy to flourish in freedom while not destroying the moral life of society, and indeed by shielding it from doubts which the philosophic type needs and must have the freedom to live with. Well, that's it for me, and I hope there'll be some comments.
again take a four. Thank you very much. We will once again take a 4.5-minute break. Then we'll have a panel, and we'll have an opportunity for all your questions. Okay? We'll see you in 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
Go ahead. Very nice. Okay.